Our next talk is Finney Premkumar. He is a PhD student, finishing his PhD in philosophy of science at the University of Birmingham in the UK.
Well, thank you. It's so wonderful to be here. And I want to thank the other two presenters for the wonderful presentations. We're going to look at a topic that has to do a lot with technology, but it also has to do a lot with philosophy, because a lot of the philosophical opinions and basis really navigate some of the technologies that are utilized and how we conceive of them and how we utilize them. So the title is Becoming More Than Human: Why Posthumanism and Transhumanism May Be Trying to Reach Beyond Their Grasp. Before we go any further, I just want to make a preliminary comment before I get into the content of what I want to share. See, a lot of times we get into specific positions, especially in the sciences and in technology, and there are many terms that we hear out there in the marketplace and in the media, and we don't understand that the behaviors, values, and beliefs that are often made vocal out there in the public are undergirded by a worldview. There is a conceptual scheme on the bottom level, at the core of who we are as people, as individuals, as communities. And so these core values or worldviews provide the paradigm, they provide the filtering mechanism, they provide the point of reference from which specific beliefs and values and behaviors are then enforced. And so if you really want to understand a person's values and beliefs, and especially behaviors, you got to look at their worldviews. And especially as Christians, as those who want to understand others, as those who want to be of service to others, we need to understand where they're coming from. And worldviews provide the plausibility structures, and they provide the circumscribing boundaries for beliefs. So beliefs don't just hang out there in the air. They're anchored to particular worldviews. See, it's not just facts. It's a philosophy of facts, right? Every act of perception is an act of interpretation. That's the human situation, inevitably. And so unless we understand the navigational feature of the worldview, we won't understand how beliefs are generated and how and why they are sustained over against other beliefs. So the worldview becomes very important, especially when we talk about something like posthumanism and transhumanism. And in many other views which we encounter in the world today, ultimately, they come down to a particular philosophical view about what it means to be human, what it means to think about ultimate realities like God, heaven, hell, salvation, sin, and so on. So we'll get more into that in just a few minutes. Posthumanism and transhumanism has become commonplace. There are many conferences worldwide, not just in the US, but even in China and India and Japan and various parts of the world. So it's becoming something that people are talking about, something that has gotten a lot of interest. And there are many people who are writing about it, many different programs, many different conferences, even journals that are dedicated to this particular philosophical view about technology. And so it's something that is here to stay. Technically, there's a difference between transhumanism and posthumanism. Transhumanism, if you want to look at it this way, is the process. It is a process of enhancement, prenatal genetic enhancements. Cyborgs are utilizing nanotechnology. These things are what transhumanists are concerned about. When you use your cell phone, you are unnaturally extending yourself. You're going beyond the natural features that circumscribe you as a human person, as a physical person. But you're going beyond that physicality. And that's what transhumanists say is the process by which we transcend our humanity, essentially. So think of transhumanism as a process. Think of posthumanism as a philosophical position. So posthumanism has to do with a deconstructive effort. It's a questioning of traditional assumptions about certainty, identity, and truth. So posthumanism is open-ended. In many ways, and I love using the blackboard, existence precedes essence. The traditional view is that there is an essential human nature that transcends the existentials of life. The existentials are the changing realities, okay? So one day you're identified as maybe a carpenter, you might be an engineer, you might be a teacher, you might be a professor, you might be a mom, dad, whatever it is, the existentials of life that are constantly in a state of flux. But then there is an essential nature to you. There is an essence to our humanity. But posthumanism says, take out the essence part. All you have is existence. You're thrust into this kind of Sartrean world the world of no exit, and you have no choice, and you define your essence, because there is no transcendent blueprint that you follow. It's whatever you make of yourself. So it's completely open-ended, and you define who you are. And there are no circumscribing boundaries. There is really nothing that keeps you encased within this essential nature that we used to talk about. So it goes away from the anthropocentric nature of the Renaissance, the humanism of the Renaissance and the Enlightenment. Basically, it displaces any essential meaning. And in doing so, it decentralizes and displaces the notion of human nature. That's really what it does. So it displaces it completely and makes it open-ended. So human nature is not something that is predefined. It doesn't have what you would call an essential nature to it. These are all existentials that are constantly in a state of flux, constantly being changed, constantly being renewed. And so post-humanism really talks about the blurring of technology, biology, and society in an especially post-human concern. And then they ask, why should our bodies stop at the skin? So this is essentially the outlook of the post-human. And I'm going to use post-human instead of going back and forth between transhuman and post-human because of the lack of time. Post-humanism basically talks about a boundaryless existence. Okay, there is no boundary in terms of defining who you are physically. You are boundaryless, essentially, open-ended, up for redefinition. See, this is very important because when you look at the classical period, Plato, Aristotle, and so on, and then you move on to the patristic period, about the 1st to the 5th century, we had the seven church councils, 325 AD to 787 AD, and then you had the medieval period from about the 5th to the 15th century, and then you had the Renaissance, where authority was questioned. Then you had the Enlightenment, where a sense of religion was questioned. Then you had modernity. Then you had the existentialist movement, where a sense of coherence was questioned. Then you had the postmodern movement, where a sense of reason was questioned. And then in 2018, Oxford Dictionary entered a new word into the catalog. It was called post-truth. Truth as a category was jettisoned. And then now we have the post human era. So it's a radical decentering of the person because all the foundations that can ground human nature are completely gone. They're completely gone from a theological, from a philosophical standpoint. So it's a radical decentering of the human. So the essence of post-humanism, the subject of the post-human is not man, but rather the processes of change and becoming of the natural social order and an ecology of the human and non-human technologies in which neither is distinguished from or privileged over the other. Now, if you remove the boundaries, the physical boundaries of what it means to be human, what I'm encased in, the circumscribing boundaries, then I merge with the technological environment that I'm a part of. Right? I don't just use technology, I'm part of the technology. I'm a technological unit, just like the technological environment in which I live. So when you take away the essence or essential definitions of what it means to be human, when it becomes open-ended, when the privileged status, what we might call the anthropocentric status, is gone, then you merge with the technology because you're open-ended in terms of your definition. Because the difference then between you and the machine, between you and the technological environment, is not a difference in kind. It's only a difference in degree. When there is a difference in kind, there is essential difference. When there is a difference in degree, it's merely existential, it's phenomenal. So the difference between me and the technological environment in which I live is only a difference in degree. And so there is this kind of a monistic approach, kind of merging everything into everything else, because all the definitions, all the circumscribing boundaries are essentially gone. Oh. And so if you look at the quote above, and especially in the quote down below, Nick Bostrom, who is one of the progenitors of the post-humanist movement, says, "The post-humanist is post the limited and decaying human. The embodied and corporeal aspect of the human is a basic problem that is transcended in the post-human era. We truly become unlimited and full of authentic potential." So the problem of the post-human when it comes to humanity is not the problem of sin. It's a problem of limitation. Why do we have problems in human society? Why do we encounter crisis and tragedy? Because of our limitations. Incidentally, this is why post-humanists align themselves well with Eastern philosophies. the link should be apparent. Because in Eastern philosophies, the problem is ignorance. Ignorance and limitation. It's not sin. And so a lot of post-humanists are very cordial. They're very accommodating of Eastern philosophies. And so that is one of the reasons. And so it stands to reason that if you really move in this direction, then the implications of post-humanism is the post-dual. There is no talk about spirit and matter, light and darkness, or about the binaries that we usually talk about. There is a merging of everything into one technological unit, the infosphere, if you want to call it that. Luciano Floridi calls it that, the infosphere. It's a merging of all these factors, the merging of the human and the non-human technologies, because all the definitions that are essential to keeping the distinctions alive are gone. And then thirdly, seeing the human as different in degree, as I mentioned earlier, not in kind from technological gadgets and environments. And then fourth, identifying the human as one among the technological elements in the world. So now we're moving in the direction where the human has been decentralized, where the human has been made open-ended in terms of definitional value, and the human is merged into the technology because it's a difference in degree, not a difference in kind. So essentially, you're a technological unit, and you don't just use technology, you're part of the technology that you utilize. Now, it's very easy to see how post-humanism ties in with artificial intelligence, right? If you're part and parcel of the technological unit or the technological environment in which you are part and parcel of and which you are merged into, then it stands to reason that artificial intelligence will find an ally in this philosophy of post-humanism, in this particular vision of the world. Remember, I told you it's a worldview. Post-humanists have a particular utopian vision of the world, and these technocrats are moving us in that direction. These things are happening because of a worldview navigating their beliefs and their actions and their attitudes. So we've got artificial intelligence in the mix. Now, I wanted to give you an argument that I really like in terms of arguing against artificial intelligence, but because of the lack of time, I might skip it if enough of you know about it. How many of you have heard of the Chinese room argument? Oh, wow, less than half of the room. So let me quickly, in about 2 minutes, go over this, because it's a very interesting argument. It was forwarded by John Searle, who used to teach at UC Berkeley, and it's called the Chinese room argument for a reason. So think about this. This argument really is supposed to show that there is a qualitative difference between computers and humans, okay? So follow the argument. That's a room or a building. It's completely blocked, but for our purposes, one side is open so we can see what is going on in there. So let's imagine there's a room with an input slot and an output slot. There is someone here who's a Chinese speaker who goes and inputs a set of instructions. Maybe it might say something like this. What day is it today? They input the set of instructions and they go to the other side. Remember, the room is completely enclosed. It's just open for our purposes. The man on the inside that you see is an English speaker. Doesn't speak a word of Chinese, but he has a ledger and he has a box of Chinese symbols. The ledger tells him how to manipulate those Chinese symbols. Are you with me so far? So he gets the instructions in Chinese. What day is it today? He doesn't understand a word of Chinese, but he has a ledger that helps him to manipulate the Chinese symbols. So this Chinese speaker goes to the other side to get the output. When he goes there, he gets the perfect output, and it says it in Chinese. It says today is Sunday, because this English speaker on the inside, who did not know a single word of Chinese, could not understand Chinese or speak Chinese, used the ledger and the box of symbols to manipulate the answer based on the question that he received. Are we okay so far? So what has happened is this manipulation of symbols within the system. But this Chinese speaker goes to the other side, picks up the output, it says today is Sunday in Chinese, and walks away from this machine or this unit saying, what an intelligent machine this is. But John Searle says, actually what happened inside the machine is very different. There was only symbol manipulation, there was only syntax, there was no semantic content or meaning or intentionality, okay? And that is what happens in machines. regardless of the algorithmic complexity, regardless of the information they're able to process, regardless of all these things they're able to do, there is only symbol manipulation and syntax. They will never rise to the level of gaining meaning or having understanding or having sentience or consciousness. So that's the basic argument, that there's a qualitative difference between a machine and a human person, and the machine will never gain sentience or consciousness. And so the argument is, it's not a matter of increased complexity, it's a problem of principled impossibility. So that's the argument. You can agree with it, you can disagree with it, we can talk about it during the Q&A. So what is a specific view of science and technology? I've got just a few minutes, so let me quickly rush through this. The emphasis is on the transformative nature of science, which is good. There is a transformative element to science. Science helps us with human flourishing, right? And as Christians especially, we should be thankful for that. This is God's creation, and we can utilize science for the transformative thing that we need in our human culture, in our human existence. Secondly, benefits of science in terms of improved human capacities, elimination of diseases. Who doesn't want that? Increased quality of life, improvement of life expectancy. All these things, we don't want to belittle the benefits of science. This is not an argument against science. This is putting science in its proper perspective. So there is the positive aspect. Science does help, technology does help. I've been the recipient of some of these things. My family has been the recipient of some of these things. So technological advancements do help in human flourishing. But the problem is the scientific single vision carried over from the Enlightenment. What is that single vision? That single vision is basically saying that science is the only arbiter of reality, that science comprehensively understands all of reality in the single language of mathematics. It is this Enlightenment perspective that navigates the value system and the belief system of the post-humanists, because they believe that this scientific vision, encased and manifested in technological terms, ultimately brings us the post-human world, this ideal utopia where everything will be manifested in perfect terms. Okay, so it really is a carryover from the Enlightenment. And so when we recognize the specific view of science, then we see the single vision, the scientism, essentially, the scientism that really navigates the post-human vision. A lot of things contribute to post-humanism. I don't have time to go into all of them. Let me quickly go over this and then some theological implications. The totalizing nature of science, right? Science is one intimation of reality. It's not all of it. Reality is too abundant, as Paul Feyerabend once said in his book, The Tyranny of Science. But science can become tyrannical. It can become imperialistic. And that's what happens in a post-human vision. The transcendental nature of method, right? So science overlooks the fact, or the post-humanists overlook the fact, that science in many ways, and this was my question to Donna yesterday, that science overlooks the fact that a lot of the deliverances of science, as pragmatic as they may be, don't necessarily point to truth. That's a huge argument. And if you want to talk about it, we can talk about it after this session, because everything that science does, in a sense, can be captured within what we would call empirical adequacy. It does not necessarily have truth tracking value. But that's a very philosophical position, but that is something that the post-humanists overlook. And then the transactional nature of mind. The mind is reduced to physical body states. It's called epiphenomenalism or physicalism. There are many different names for it in the philosophy of science, but there's a very transactional idea of the mind. And so they talk about the mind being downloaded into machines so that you can live for 400, 500, 600 years. Because remember, your physical part is the problem. So if we can get rid of the physical parts and download your consciousness into a machine, then you can live on for hundreds of years. And then four, the tarnished reputation of the other non-science disciplines in academia. This happened during the Enlightenment, the split between the exact sciences, physics, chemistry, and biology, and the social sciences, unfortunately, because they were seen as the lesser sciences. And that paradigm continues in the post-human era. So very quickly, I'll just take about a minute or so to go through this. A Christian response to post-humanism. What do we do? How do we respond? How do we think about this? Let me just point out a few things, then we can pick it up during the Q&A. The purpose and extent of enhancement. Think about it in creational terms. Is it in alignment with God's original creational intent? The enhancements, do they enhance natural abilities, or do they enhance something that is beyond your natural ability? Do they give you abilities that are not natural to you? So that's one question we need to ask. You know, do they help you in terms of your natural abilities that you might have lost because of illness or sickness or something that happened? So they help you regain it, or are they getting you beyond your natural abilities? In terms of redemption, posthumanism identifies a human problem not in terms of transgressions, but in terms of transcendence. The way it addresses brokenness is to become unbreakable. And that is essentially the vision of the posthumanist. Get you to the point where your consciousness is downloaded, where your physical components are removed, where you can live for 500, 600, 700 years, on and on, for eternity, perhaps. So that is the basic essence of what they believe in. In terms of the incarnation, when you downplay the importance of the physical, what are you doing? The Word became flesh and dwelt among us in the person of Christ. That's what we read in John 1:1. The hypostatic union loses its meaningfulness. In terms of resurrection, the bodily resurrection of Christ, if Christ not be raised from the dead, then our faith is in vain. There is something more to be said about this. I don't have time right now, but think about the resurrection, what that does to the resurrection when it decentralizes the nature of humanity, and especially the physicality that we consummate. And then consummation, where does a posthuman end up? God's purpose or in some undefined future? The posthumanists don't define the future. It's open-ended, remember? And you just get to live on and on. But the biblical theme of providence and God having this eschatological vision for us in terms of how things come to a conclusion is completely left behind. It's completely open-ended. And so these are some of the concerns that we should have, some of the things that we should think about. And remember, posthumanism is not just a position. It's not just a particular belief. It's a philosophical outlook. And they have a particular vision of the now and the future. And as Christians, we need to critically engage with them. Thank you.
I'd like to comment on this idea of that only AI can do symbol translation, as you, right. Your picture showed. And this maybe relates to the earlier speaker. I understand, the earlier speaker pointed out the large language models say that any word has a probability from all language that the next word will be. And it has actually a table of probabilities. There's the most probable word, the least probable, and so forth. And I understand that the way these models make the final output look more human, they don't always pick the most probable sequence. If they do, it sounds very unhuman. But if they start sort of pick the sequence as sort of randomly, you probably would pick the higher ranked ones. But if it's all most probable, it's very dead. Whereas if you pick some higher probability ones and not always the same ones, then it sounds more human. So could you care to comment on that? And that's in a sense, I think, the way AI tries to make it sound more human.
Oh, yeah. No, definitely. But see, the language changed. John Searle released his book, Minds, Brains, and Science in the 1980s, when MIT and Stanford were at the peak of the AI research, because by that time, we were moving from machine language to deep learning. When his book was released, one of the things that happened was a language change. We moved from replication to simulation because computers cannot replicate. They can only simulate, right? And so no matter what they do in terms of the complexity, they only simulate. The human mind is computational to a certain extent. And neuroeconomics, one particular area of study, looks into the computational nature of the mind. But the problem is it cannot be reduced to pure computation. That's reductionism. And so there is a sense of compatibility between computers and the human mind in terms of computation. But the problem is when you reduce everything to purely computational methods, that's where the problem comes in. And neuroeconomics shows that. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the question.
I have a question about the science, the scientific imperialism that transhumanism represents. And specifically, my question is, I look at the proposal of to a computer,
right,
and I say that doesn't seem to me to be a sober assessment, a sober scientific assessment, right, of what we can actually do right now.
Yeah.
And so one of the questions I have is, are the transhumanists dealing in reality, dealing with truth tracking with respect to the capabilities of science, or to what extent does science just serve as an object?
Right.
That they use.
Yeah. No, that's a wonderful question. Actually, yeah, that's a pretty big question. It'll take some time. But Let me just put it into two or three statements. They generally believe in something like epiphenomenalism, where brain states or mind states or mental states or mental causation is nothing more than physical states, right? They supervene on physical states. And so, first of all, the big problem is we don't even understand what consciousness is, right? It's just a term that we utilize in order to talk about certain aspects of humanity. We really don't understand what it is. So I'm with you on that. I really don't know what they mean by downloading consciousness, but they do talk about consciousness only in terms of brain states. So maybe they're thinking of utilizing your brain and somehow putting it into a system and making it operate somehow. Because for them, mental causation and mental content does not exist independent of brain states or physical states. So I'm with you on that. So most of them are epiphenomenalists or physicalists. Some of them are non-reductive physicalists, but still, they get into some sort of epiphenomenalism. But I agree, we don't understand consciousness enough to do any of this. Yeah.
Thank you for your presentation. I have two questions. What would you say to people like Neil deGrasse Tyson, who is basically, I'm bringing it up because he has very strong views against philosophers, and that basically he downplays that discipline as completely unimportant to the scientist. So what would you say to young scientists who are thinking about these issues and also listening to someone like deGrasse Tyson? That's the first question. And the second question would be, what about Christians who can look at transhumanism and say, can we redeem it? Maybe this is the way we can bring about the new Jerusalem or the new millennium. This is the way we would extend ourselves and cure. And how does that work? Because I like we heard this morning, it's like there are some theologians bringing about new theologies that I've never heard before.
Right.
So how does that work?
Yeah, in terms of Tyson, and I hesitate to say this, but I'll say it. I think he needs to apologize just like Stephen Hawking did for his book, The Grand Design. I don't know if any of you know about this. Stephen Hawking actually had to apologize for making some statements in the book, The Grand Design, that he wrote, I think, maybe about 10, 12 years ago, because he made a statement that theology is obsolete. Right. And he teaches at Cambridge, which is one of the foremost theological departments in the world. So the faculty took issue with it and he made a public apology. So what happens in terms of science, and it also happens in the religious realm, is that people use credentials in one area to talk about other areas that they have no clue about. And it happens with a lot of scientists. It happens with Stephen Hawking. It happens with Richard Dawkins, the God delusion. It even happened with philosophers like Bertrand Russell, Why I'm Not a Christian. So that's a problem. And that's a problem in the religious sector as well. Sometimes we have people in ministry who talk about science without knowing the science, and they make statements just like Tyson or Stephen Hawking. In terms of transhumanists utilizing all of this for eschatological view, I would be very cautious, because it's not by changing our humanity, but by understanding our humanity that we usher in this new world, this new realm that the Bible talks about. It's not by transcending ourselves, but by really understanding who we are in the deepest of our natures, that redemption that we need. Because in the transhumanist perspective, it is not redemption, it's almost realization that you're unlimited, that you're open-ended. So that is a very mystical kind of Eastern philosophy, and that's why they kind of accommodate Eastern philosophies. It's a very Buddhist Hindu view, New Age view in many ways as well. And so a lot of physicists actually are into Eastern philosophy, and a lot of post-humanists, including Nick Bostrom, are into Eastern philosophy. So we've got to be very careful. In terms of our eschatological vision, it's by understanding the depths of our humanity and our need for our redemption and the consummation that finally happens in and through Christ.
Well, thanks, Finney, for that talk. Thank you.